Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her beast. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her young women to call from the highest places in the town. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To him who lacks sense, she says, come, eat of my bread and drink of the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and live, and walk in the ways of insight. Whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse, and he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase in learning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. For by me your days will be multiplied, and your years will be added to your life. If you are wise, you are wise for yourself. If you scoff, you alone will bear it. The woman folly is loud. She is seductive and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house. She takes a seat on the highest places of the town, calling to those who pass by, who are going straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol.
Well, let me invite you to Proverbs 9 one more time. And if you don't have a Bible, you can look it up on your phone. I'd encourage you to follow along. I'm just going to teach through Proverbs 9 and try to explain what those verses mean for us by what they say. So Proverbs 9, page 533, if you need to use the Bible that's available for you under the seat there in front of you. You've probably read or heard read or were exposed in some torturous literature class in seventh grade Robert Frost's famous poem, The Road Not Taken. Anybody heard The Road Not Taken? Oh, that's what I thought. I'm preaching a book of poetry. I'm going to start this sermon with a little poetry. Here's how it goes. Two roads, this is at least how it starts. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, and then took the other. It's one of the most beloved poems, at least in our country, written by an American, especially the ending with that proud celebration of individual choice. Remember how it ends? It goes like this. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. What a celebration of the self-made person, right? See, world, I chose my own way and it turned out right. Take that. I used to love that poem. Until I learned about 15 years ago that that's not what the poem means at all. That's actually not what Robert Frost meant it to celebrate. I'd been reading it all wrong. Robert Frost wrote that poem as a joke for his friend Edward Thomas, who used to have a hard time making simple decisions. He and Robert, Edward and Robert, would go on these walks together, and they would get to a fork in the road, and Edward would quibble over which way and what the differences would be, and then they'd head off down one of these paths, and he would complain about how that probably would have been a better trail. So Robert Frost wrote this little ironic poem to force a chuckle over his friend's obsession because it didn't really matter which path you took. And that's what the middle stanzas are about, which most people tend to blow right by. They read like this. Then took the other as just as fair, having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves. No step had trodden black. Oh, I'll keep the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever be back. And then the closing stanza, that has made all the difference. The paths, though, are essentially the same. Yes, people make decisions and they can't reverse them. But the trail you take through the woods is hardly a life-changing decision, right? I mean, that's the point of the poem. He's not celebrating the trailblazers among us. He's gently mocking them. What you did wasn't all that original most of the time. He's using irony to help us see that most of the big important decisions we fret over actually aren't that big and that important or worth fretting over. Bummer, right? Sorry to ruin your favorite poem. If you misunderstood the poem like I used to, don't worry. The first time Robert Frost read the poem to a group of college students, they loved it because they misunderstood it the same way we all did. He even sent it to Edward Thomas, and that guy misunderstood it. In fact, he warned Robert Frost, once Frost explained the joke to him, he warned him that readers are not going to be able to get this joke. And I suppose there's a lesson for us in all of this, driving us to Proverbs, for how easy it is to mistake which choices in life actually matter, right? Literary critic David Orr has written an entire book about the road not taken and how we Americans with this culture where we love our choices. American culture is the culture of choice, and I don't mean that in any way that has anything to do with abortion. It's just about, like, we love to have all of our options open. Well, David Orr, this literary critic, wrote a whole book on the road not taken saying, Americans' love of culture sets us up to miss the irony and misunderstand this poem. We have a bigger disadvantage than anybody else in getting this poem right. Here's the subtitle of his book. It's called The Road Not Taken. Finding America in the Poem Everyone Loves and Almost Everyone Gets Wrong. Here's the point. We, especially we Americans, we seem to have a pathological ability to overemphasize the trivial and underemphasize the critical. Do you see that in your culture? And more to the point, because we're not here to point fingers at anybody else, do you see that in yourself? The tendency to overemphasize the trivial as a parent, as a young person growing up into the world, and then underemphasize the critical. It's one of the lessons we've been learning from the book of Proverbs, right? Chapter 9 drives that point home. Nothing could be more important to our lives than getting wisdom, and yet so many people miss it. And so chapter 9 is meant to call us to get it. Like Robert Frost, this ancient sage, is telling us, we do have a choice to make and we're going to have to live with it. But unlike Robert Frost, this guy is telling us the choice you make regarding wisdom, and that actually matters a lot. He's not teasing us here in Proverbs 9. He's urging us. So if you're sitting on the fence a little bit, you're interested in this topic, but you haven't actually made any changes yet, let me urge you, this is the decision time. Please make it a priority every day to grow in wisdom. And for you young people, teens, 20s, 30s, this book is written to people at your stage in life, urging you. I'm urging you. This ancient sage is urging you. Get wisdom. Maybe you're here and you're not even following Jesus. You're just sort of listening in. You're curious. You came with a friend, something like that. You might think the wisdom of the Bible is actually kind of goofy. Well, let me tell you something. You're in a room, you might be surprised to learn, you're in a room filled with people, many of whom used to think the same thing. I know I did. I thought the stuff in the Bible was the height of foolishness. So, I actually want to talk about that a little bit too in this passage. And if you hang in there toward the end of the talk, I'll explain why we tend to think that way and how the foolishness of a man hanging on a cross is actually the height, the foolishness of that is actually the height of wisdom. That's where we want to end this talk. So let me just show you, look at chapter 9. It has three sections. Each one of them is six verses long, three stanzas. Verses 1 through 6 are a portrait of wisdom. 7 through 12 is a call for a decision or a challenge. And then verses 13 to 18 are a portrait of woman folly. So the first stanza and the third stanza actually go together. The portrait of wisdom and the portrait of folly, they're supposed to go together. It's not that the, you know, poet got them out of order. It's just that we're supposed to compare them. So I want to actually do those two stanzas together. We'll go through verses 1 through 6 and verses 13 to 18, and we'll compare wisdom and folly. And then we'll look at that middle stanza, which is the heart of the thing, and get the challenge, which will you choose? All right? So stanza 1, verses 1 through 6. Look at your Bible. I want you to see I'm not making this up. This is how it reads. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her beasts. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her young women to call from the highest places in the town. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks sense, she says, come, eat of my bread and drink of the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of insight. All right, some of that sounds familiar because of what we've seen earlier in Proverbs, but here's something different. We've seen Lady Wisdom twice calling out to people, chapter 1 and then chapter 8. And in both of those places, chapter 1, verses 20 to 21, chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, you can just look across the page maybe and see it. In both of those occasions, she's been out in public. She's been in the town. She's just talking to people who are passing by on the street, going about their business. But here, she's calling from a different location, isn't she? Where is she calling from? Her own house. It's quite a mansion, isn't it? Seven pillars, verse 1, that she cut herself from stone. Verse 2, she has a table set with a feast that she's prepared just for you, apparently. Verse 3, her house is staffed by a platoon of messenger girls that she sent out to gather people in. This is an impressive woman. She owns quite a mansion. Notice three things. Number one, she's not just speaking to the passerbys. She sends messengers out to get them. God has sent messengers to you, speaking wisdom. Young people, your parents are one of Lady Messenger's handmaidens that she has sent into your life to speak wisdom. Pastors, prophets, good Christian friends, there are people who speak to you, and those are Lady Wisdom's messengers bidding you. Notice secondly, anyone is welcome. Verse 4, you don't have to be bookish. You don't have to be spiritual. You don't have to be churchy. She says, whoever is simple, come on in. At one time or another, that characterized all of us, right? She's not just waiting for the elite or the super like into spirituality. She's just asking anybody who wants to come, come on in. And finally, notice what she's inviting you to. Now, yes, this is Lady Wisdom. But notice she's not inviting you to class. She's not inviting you to a seminar. You don't have to have your notepad and pencil. You need to have your knife and fork, right? She's inviting you to a meal. She's not passing out books. She has slaughtered beasts, I guess. And for those of you who are vegetarians, the actual Hebrew word there doesn't mean tofu. It actually means beasts, with all respect for vegetarianism. She's serving up prime rib. I just cannot let an opportunity like that go by, can I? I apologize. She's serving dinner. And notice this whole picture, when you put it together, is wow. This is an exclusive private dinner at her home with this impressive, desirable woman. In other words, wisdom is inviting you not to a seminar or even to a single meal. She's inviting you to an intimate relationship. That's what this picture is meant to evoke in your life. You're meant to hear that she's welcoming you into an intimate relationship in your life. She wants to be at the center. This is supposed to sound like the beginnings of an appropriate proposition. Come on in, share a meal with me, get to know me. This is an offering of herself to you, intimately, not just at a surface level, but something deep and rich. That's Lady Wisdom. Now let's look at Woman Folly, verses 13 to 18. The woman Folly is loud. She's seductive and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house. She takes a seat on the highest places of the town, calling to those who pass by who are going straight on their way, "Whoever is simple, let him turn in here." I feel like we just heard that. And to him who lacks sense, she says, "Stolen water is sweet. Bread eaten in secret is pleasant." But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. Well, there's several differences, right? Lady Folly is sitting. Lady Wisdom is doing all sorts of things. But they both have a house, but Lady Wisdom's house is pretty impressive, isn't it? Seven pillars. None of that description here. Lady Wisdom is serving up fresh meat and mixed wine. Woman Folly is serving up bread and water. If you look closely, you can see Wisdom is superior. But the thing that really starts to stand out to me are all the similarities. Did you notice them? They're both offering from their house, verse 1, verse 14. They offer the exact same words in their invite, verse 4. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. Verse 16, whoever is simple, let him turn in here. They have the very same target audience, same verse, 4:16, him who lacks sense. They're both serving dinner. In other words, they're both offering this intimate, exclusive relationship in private with a moderately impressive woman. What is the point of all these similarities? Well, a couple of things. Number one, this isn't as obvious a choice in real life as it might appear in church. In church, we can talk about wisdom and folly and life and death, and you're like, yeah, I mean, heck, I don't want to die. I mean, I'd love to go that way. But in real life, at first, they sound a lot the same. They look a lot the same. And although in this case, wisdom and folly are inviting you into their home, they're still hollering out to people who are just passing by. In other words, you didn't have to sign up for a seminar to get a lecture from Folly. In everyday life, foolishness is speaking to you in the product ads and in the input you hear from friends or news pundits or the things that whisper to you from your own heart on the inside. There's foolishness all over the place just beckoning you. And at first it looks just like wisdom. If you look close, you can see the differences, but at first they look the same. The other thing that's being impressed on us here is the need to make a choice. This is an either-or proposition. The road forks. As Robert Frost said, you cannot walk both paths and be one traveler. You will live under the influence every moment, every day of either wisdom or folly. Inviting or responding to the invite of one is necessarily declining the invite of the other. That's the point. But I want you to notice one other similarity and think about that for a moment. Did you notice that they both have built their house at the highest places of the town? That's verse 14 for Woman Folly. Verse 3, the messenger women from wisdom go to the highest places in town. In Solomon's day, in the ancient world, for his readers, that instantly would have meant something to them. Do you know what kind of houses were built at the highest point in town? Houses of worship. Do you know who lived at the top of the hill or the top of the biggest mountain in town? The gods. In other words, there's something very religious happening in this offer. And that's why, again, I keep coming back to this passage that James made so clear for us in Proverbs 2. In Proverbs 2, there's this urge, there's this summons to the son. Give everything you've got to get wisdom. Seek it, cry for it, search for it. Search for it like you're trying to find hidden treasure in gold, in silver, in jewels. And if you do, then you will find the fear of the Lord. Then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. In other words, if you seek wisdom, you'll actually meet God. You'll find God himself. Lady Wisdom and Woman Folly are calling people not just to eat, not just to meet them, not just to learn, but to worship. Because wisdom is the personification of God's wisdom. It's a picture of God himself, which means if wisdom is a stand-in for the living God, then folly must be a stand-in for all the rival gods. In Solomon's world, that was Asherah and Marduk and Baal and Ishtar and Chemosh and Molech. I don't know how many of you have been summoned to worship them this week. I haven't. But I have been summoned to worship gods. God's not named Jesus. Haven't you? The product ads are beckoning you. Turn in here and I'll give you pleasure. Listen to me and I'll deliver popularity. I'll make you famous. I'll give you power. I'll give you wealth and riches. Those are the gods of our age. And Lady Wisdom offers you the living God, and Woman Folly offers you all of these false gods. But man, is it alluring, isn't it? Look at verse 16. There's something about this that is so alluring to us. Sorry, verse 17. Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. There's something alluring to a sinner about things that are secret and forbidden. I remember a couple of decades ago taking a group of high school students to work at the Pontiac Rescue Mission in Michigan. And we were organizing their food pantry and sorting all the shelves where they had cans and cans of tomatoes and green beans and who knows what all. And we were like organizing that whole room. And in the course of kind of coordinating all the students that I had brought, I walked down the hallway a little ways in the basement of this ancient building in downtown Pontiac and was just amazed by all the stuff. And then I came across this door that said, "Do not enter, keep door closed." I mean, you know what you would have done. Don't judge me. But absolutely, I promise you. I just, you know, walked by and then kind of turned around and looked. Nobody was around. Stuck my head in there. I'm not telling you what was in there. I shouldn't have gotten that knowledge. Wasn't supposed to be looking at that. What is it about, it was just like a mechanical room. There was nothing in there. Maybe they were fumigating for spiders and they put the sign up, you know, don't open this door, contaminate, I don't know. The simple fact that the sign said no made me want to do it. What is it about that? What is it about us? There's something about, high school students, middle schoolers, college students, 20, 30, all of us, you're not the only one who hears that something shouldn't be done and goes, why do I want to do that so badly? All right, Proverbs tells you, Woman Folly is telling you expressly, it's part of her pitch, that stolen water is especially sweet And bread. I mean, it's just bread. But if we like, shh, don't tell anybody, we're going to eat this bread. Suddenly it's exciting and even more sensational. And destructive. Look at verse 18. The guy that enters in there doesn't know the dead are there and her guests are in the depths of Sheol. What a surprise, right? I mean, bread and water aren't a great meal, but usually if you eat them, it's enough to give you strength for the next day. Not this meal. This bread and water, the sage tells us, will kill you. Is that an exaggeration? I mean, how many people thought, I'm just going to try this one time? And that was all it took. How many people said, I don't know if I should have that bread, but just one bite. I just finished reading the memoir of a really popular 90s celebrity. And it was so tragic and just heart-wrenching because of years and years of addiction that this person battled and never got over to the end of their life. And tells the story of shooting on a movie set located at Lake Mead and rode a jet ski and launched himself off the jet ski and twisted up his neck, and his doctor gave him a pill and said, here, this will help you. If you're not feeling well enough to shoot in the morning, take this. And he said, my whole life changed at that moment. It wasn't the doctor's fault, but when I took that one pill and felt my blood turn to warm honey, within 18 months, I had to have 55 of those pills every day. Does it happen on the first bite? With some people, it does. With some people, the first bite means every bite after that is guaranteed. So the warning here is don't take the first one. Right? I know this sounds prudish, but think for a moment about the possibility that it's actually true, because Proverbs would tell you it is. So here we have two different women, two different houses, two different paths, two different options, two different destinies. Will you be wise or foolish? Make your choice. But how can you tell who you're listening to? That's what that middle stanza is about, verses 7 through 12. Verses 7 through 12 have several things going on. The bulk of it is two tests. Two tests to see who you're listening to. Then there's a promise, verse 11, and a warning, verse 12. Look at the tests in verses 7 through 10. Whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse. He who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Don't reprove a scoffer or he'll hate you. So three lines warning you of the same thing. You reprove that kind of fool, it'll go bad for you. Now there's three lines saying essentially the same thing the other direction. Reprove a wise man and he'll love you. Give instruction to a wise man and he'll be wiser still. Teach a righteous man and he will increase learning. This is the first test to find out who you're listening to. Who are you becoming? The test is, how do you respond to correction? How do you respond when someone tells you probably shouldn't do that? When someone says the first bite might be the last one? How do you respond to that? It's fools, it's people under the influence of woman folly who recoil against that, who stiffen up against that, who hate that, who say, yeah, well, whatever, or worse. It's a mark of wisdom to receive that kind of teaching, that kind of criticism, because it's impossible to grow if you can't acknowledge your mistakes, right? And if you want to grow, you've got to say, yep, thank you, appreciate that. The first test, how do you respond to correction? The second test, how do you think about God? Verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. How do you think about God? That phrase, the fear of the Lord, it's central to the message of the book of Proverbs, and here's what it means. It doesn't mean you're just terrified by God, you cower in his presence. It means you take him seriously in all that he is. Yes, he's holy and righteous and powerful, so you ought to approach him with some certain mindfulness. But he's overwhelmingly generous and good and kind and bids you to come through Jesus. So you ought to approach him with boldness and joy, All of that is the fear of the Lord because you're taking him seriously. The opposite of the fear of the Lord is to just not take him that seriously, to not deal with him, to push him to the margins. So the test is, how do you think about God? How do you know if you're listening to Lady Wisdom or if you're being drawn under the influence of woman folly? How do you respond to correction, verses 7 through 9, and how do you think about God, verse 10? Then there's a promise and a warning. Look at verse 11, the promise. By me, your days will be multiplied and years will be added to your life. We've been hearing this from Lady Wisdom all through this book. She offers life. I love how Ray Ortland puts this. He says, those who follow wisdom, those who listen to wisdom, live more and more forever. Folly's playmates die a sugar-coated death before they even know what hit them. Verse 12 is a warning. It's a challenge. You've got the promise in verse 11 and then the warning in verse 12. If you are wise, you are wise for yourself. If you scoff, you alone will bear it. In other words, no one can make the choice for you. You have to choose. And when you choose, you will benefit if you choose well. And you alone will suffer if you choose poorly. Well, the choice seems obvious, right? I mean, life versus death, that's easy. But there's that thing about folly that is so seductive, right? Stolen water is sweet, bread eaten in secret. What is going on here? Well, the Old Testament doesn't explain to us very much why we're bent that way, why we're suspicious of God, why it is that the forbidden door offers this alluring interest and you can't resist, even if you're the one that's supposed to be setting an example for all the other people. The Old Testament doesn't explain much, but Jesus showed up and he does. Remember, the Jews had all of their law, which oriented them to the things they ate and the way they washed, and that was right because it was sending a message about approaching God. But Jesus showed up and said, it's not how you eat or even what you eat. It's what's inside you that makes the difference, because out of your heart come all of these evil things. The brokenness is in here, was Jesus's point. Our love of foolishness goes all the way down into who we are, and it warps our perception entirely, and we start seeing foolishness as wise and wisdom as foolishness. And do you see that on display in our world? Do you see people professing themselves wise who have become fools? Do you see it in your life? Do you see it in your own story, this habitual foolishness, this tendency to choose things that will destroy you? Well, think about this. According to Proverbs, yes, two roads diverged, but not in a yellow wood. They diverged at the foot of two mountains, two hills, the highest hills in town. One leads up the path to the glorious home of Lady Wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the foundation. All those who gather worship only Jesus, the true God. This other road leads to the temple of idolatry, where fools gather to worship gods of their own culture and gods of their own heart and gods of their own making. And here's the irony of all of that. Those fools think they're on the path to wisdom. They think this is the smarter way, the better way. They believe that the real fools in the world are Christians, that to believe in God and embrace ideas about an afterlife and like a God who died on the cross for sins, like that's the height of foolishness. Friends, it's always been that way. It's not our world that came up with that as a foolish idea or viewed that as a foolish idea. It's been that way since Jesus came. Most of the people that encountered Jesus were impressed by his miracles and driven away by his teaching and thought he was foolish. There were a few that saw wisdom in him. Remember the Magi? What do we call the Magi? The wise men, what did they do? They worshiped him. But the king didn't. Most of the religious leaders didn't. Most of the people in Jerusalem didn't. They just rejected him. His life proved that he was wisdom, right? He himself said, the queen of Sheba will rise up in the judgment and condemn these men because she came from the ends of the earth to behold the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, someone greater than Solomon is here. Jesus claimed to be the greatest wisdom of all. How could he make that claim? Well, at the end of his life, he climbed up a hill, didn't he? Built, if you will, a temple with his own hands. He calls out to people, whoever is simple, let him turn in here, worship me, and become wise. And Christians ever since have. Paul writes, in the wisdom of God, the world, since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through its wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. Jews demand signs, Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God, for the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Why have Christians always viewed the cross as great wisdom? Because how else, what else would you call it but the height of wisdom for a man to take the wrath of God on himself and for anyone who trusts him to be completely forgiven? What else would you call it but the wisdom of God for the death of one man to be a seed sown into the ground for the healing of the whole world? How does that wisdom? Well, what else helps you to reconcile with someone? What else inclines your heart to humble yourself before someone than when they lay their weapons down? Than when they stop attacking you and stop fighting you? This is God laying his weapons down going, look, I know you think I've got it out for you. I know you think I'm the problem. Look at what I'm offering you. And suddenly your heart melts and you go, oh my goodness, I've never thought of God that way. I remember years ago meeting a man who was so angry because all of the things that had happened in his life and that had made him so, on the one hand, sad, but deeply angered. And he told me, sitting across the lunch table from me, made me a little scared. He told me, there are times that I drive by churches and I just want to stop and go in that place and get my hands on whoever is in there and choke them out. Because if I could get my hands on God, that's what I would do to him. I just want to choke him. I want to hurt him. I said, do you know why Jesus came? So that people could finally get their hands on him. And they killed him. So that God could forgive them. He just kind of rocked back and caught his breath and said, I've never thought about God that way. Yeah, most people haven't. Because they think it's foolishness until they actually see the wisdom. Years ago, archaeologists found some graffiti in a tomb, scratched on the wall, dating back to about AD 200, about a century and a half after Jesus. There was a picture of a man hanging on a cross. Underneath, it had an inscription. Alexander, a man hanging on a cross and another man bowing before that man on the cross, and an inscription underneath it said, Alexander worships his God. And the man on the cross had the head of a donkey. He's worshiping an ass. Well, the world's always called it foolishness. So friends, the real question is not, will you be a fool and follow woman folly? The real question is, what kind of fool will you be? Will you be the fool that embraces the foolishness of God's wisdom in Jesus on the cross, beckoning you to fellowship with him and base your life on him? Or will you be the kind of fool that thinks all of this is real wisdom and that path is leading to death? That's what Proverbs 9 is about. The choice is yours. Let's pray that you make the right one. Father, I ask that you would open our eyes to see that what appears foolish is actually wise. Help us live under the influence of Jesus, our wisdom, every day. Help these students and 20-somethings and 30-year-olds, these people who are in the earliest years, the formative years of their life, to come under the influence of your wisdom by knowing Christ and making him the center of their life. Give us all the grace to resist the alluring offer of woman folly. so that we would live. We ask this for your glory and for our life in you. In Jesus' name, amen.